A personal message from the executive editor, the powerful gatekeepers of free speech, thought. In this week's edition, we're focusing on the issue of censorship as it more strongly rears its ugly head in the public and private sectors today. In columns by Paul Craig Roberts, Ron Ray, Dave Gallery, and Kevin Barrett, we take an in-depth look at how corporations like Amazon and Google, institutions of higher learning, nonprofits, and special interest groups have been circling the wagons around the establishment in a concerted effort to stamp out criticism of the ruling elites. So far, they've been unable to stifle free speech completely, but that doesn't mean they're not advancing their dangerous agenda. Officially, there is no central authority coordinating this level of censorship, but powerful and organized special interests working behind the scenes have been using their considerable resources to rein in what we all can read in books and newspapers and hear and watch on the radio and television. No doubt this is a complicated subject, but, essentially, what we're talking about is that under the rubric of labeling any alternative view as fake and misleading, private corporations and institutions, working at the behest of governments, special interest groups, and wealthy individuals, have been trying to blacklist media outlets and individuals that have the courage to veer off the path of accepted thought. Regular readers already know the touchy subjects that they're trying to police. Typically, these involve views that run counter to the establishment when it comes to the Middle East, World War II history, the September 11th attacks, and big government. The problem today, though, is that, since they cannot counter the arguments outright, they feel compelled to just shut us down any way they can. It was only 50 years ago that George Orwell wrote his famous book 1984. We reference this prescient work in the commentary by Paul Angel on the front page of the March 13th and 20th issue of AFP. It's frightening, the parallels that are occurring today. In his book, Orwell tells the story of fictional character Winston Smith, whose job as an editor at the Ministry of Truth is to essentially engage in a form of historical revisionism. He routinely censors reports to the public, scrubbing any mention of what they refer to as unpersons, people who simply speak out against the ruling power. Ironically, today, it is mostly the historical revisionists who have been bucking the elites and often find themselves the targets of the powers that be. AFP columnists are certainly no strangers to this and have been on the receiving end of the forces advancing censorship. Paul Craig Roberts and Dr. Kevin Barrett, to name but two, have faced this very treatment head-on, with Roberts being banned from mainstream publications and unable to find work in colleges and universities, and Barrett being fired from the university he taught at. Thankfully, there are organizations like American Free Press and the Foundation to Defend the First Amendment, FDFA, whose staff are out there every day defending free speech and thought on the front lines. The First Amendment may only apply directly to the federal government, but it is clear that our founding fathers held the notion of free expression above all other inalienable rights. After all, it is our ability to think and speak freely that makes us all Americans. Please take a stand for free speech today and support American Free Press and FDFA. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, WikiLeaks Open CIA Secret Vault 7, Hacking Tools, Surveillance Tricks, Appalling Invasion of Privacy Revealed. Earlier this month, the international whistleblowing organization, WikiLeaks, released information that it had been handed millions of lines of code that the CIA uses to spy on governments, individuals, and organizations around the world, by John Friend. In early March, WikiLeaks, the notorious international organization that works with whistleblowers, hackers, and other anonymous individuals to expose secret and classified information detailing government corruption and malfeasance, published the first installment of what has been described as the largest ever collection of secret government and intelligence files, all of which pertain to the CIA, America's top spy agency. The data dump, codenamed Vault 7 by WikiLeaks, includes thousands of secret CIA documents detailing a rogue agency that has focused much of its attention and resources on hacking, spying, and cyber warfare. but failed to secure and protect its capabilities. The initial release of secret documents, totaling 8,761 files originating from an isolated, high-security network situated inside the CIA's Center for Cyber Intelligence in Langley, Virginia, is known as Year Zero, and exposes a variety of arguably illegal and certainly concerning CIA activities, according to a press release published by WikiLeaks. Year Zero introduces the scope and direction of the CIA's global covert hacking program, its malware arsenal, and dozens of zero-day weaponized exploits against a wide range of U.S. and European company products, including Apple's iPhone, Google's Android, and Microsoft's Windows, and even Samsung TVs, which are turned into covert microphones, WikiLeaks's press release describing its latest data dump states. Recently, the CIA lost control of the majority of its hacking arsenal, including malware, viruses, trojans, weaponized zero-day exploits, malware remote control systems, and associated documentation. This extraordinary collection, which amounts to more than several hundred million lines of code, gives its possessor the entire hacking capacity of the CIA. The archive appears to have been circulated among former U.S. government hackers and contractors in an unauthorized manner, one of whom has provided WikiLeaks with portions of the archive. In a press conference announcing and highlighting the findings of the initial publication of the documents associated with Vault 7, WikiLeaks founder and chief spokesman Julian Assange charged the CIA with devastating incompetence for failing to protect and secure its hacking secrets and pledged to work with various technology companies to address the vulnerabilities. "This is a historic act of devastating incompetence, to have created such an arsenal and then stored it all in one place," Assange averred. "It is impossible to keep effective control of cyber weapons. If you build them, eventually you will lose them." Assange went on to note that his organization possessed a lot more information about the CIA's cyber warfare operations, which includes its hacking and surveillance capabilities, malware systems, and viruses, and vowed to wait to release the information until technology companies and manufacturers had been consulted. "We have decided to work with them, tech companies, to give them some exclusive access to the additional technical details we have so fixes can be developed and then pushed out," Assange stated. "Once this material is effectively disarmed by us, we will publish additional details about what has been occurring. Of particular importance in the recent WikiLeaks disclosures is the fact that the CIA, especially since 9/11, has developed its own substantial fleet of hackers." According to the press release published by WikiLeaks announcing its initial release of Vault 7, the agency's hacking division freed it from having to disclose its often controversial operations to the NSA, its primary bureaucratic rival. In order to draw on the NSA's hacking capacities, the press release states, by the end of 2016, the CIA's hacking division, which formally falls under the agency's Center for Cyber Intelligence, CCI, had over 5,000 registered users and had produced more than 1,000 hacking systems, trojans, viruses, and other weaponized malware. Such is the scale of the CIA's undertaking that by 2016, its hackers had utilized more code than that used to run Facebook. The CIA had created, in effect, its own NSA with even less accountability and without publicly answering the question as to whether such a massive budgetary spend on duplicating the capacities of a rival agency could be justified. Glenn Greenwald, a journalist close to Assange who worked with Edward Snowden to expose a variety of shady and illegal U.S. government spying operations, recently appeared on the BBC to weigh in on the latest revelations by WikiLeaks. "One very significant revelation is that the CIA actively encourages and at times even pays various companies and organizations to preserve vulnerabilities that they are able to exploit in a lot of these software programs, which means that not only they can go through these backdoors that they make sure exist, but so can hacker groups or terrorist organizations or other nation states. It shows the CIA, like the NSA, is making the internet more unsafe for everyone, and I think that's very disturbing. Greenwald noted, WikiLeaks's primary source for the secret CIA documents that have and will be released argues these issues urgently need to be debated in public and aims to initiate a public debate about the security, creation, use, proliferation, and democratic control of cyber weapons, given the secrecy surrounding the CIA and the power it has amassed since its creation. Getting to the bottom of all of this will no doubt prove to be a major challenge. Do not expect the CIA and other deep state actors to willingly cooperate with WikiLeaks. Billionaire bankster bites the dust. David Rockefeller leaves behind a new world order rejected by the people. Scion of elite banking family passed away quietly in March, leaving behind a legacy of globalist machinations to form a one-world government. Known for helping establish the infamous Bilderberg Group, David Rockefeller has been absent from the annual gathering of late. Early predictions have this year's Bilderberg meeting likely taking place in Virginia, by Mark Anderson. When John D. Rockefeller passed away March 20 at the age of 101, the last of the five grandsons of oil titan John D. Rockefeller, besides David, they were John D. III, Winthrop, Lawrence and Nelson, left behind a new world order, something that this oil and banking dynastic family labored heavily to build. It's instructive to keep in mind that Rockefeller, whose NWO efforts were partly conducted through his longtime presidency of Chase Manhattan Bank, was instrumental in solidifying the influence of the infamous Bilderberg Group. Bilderberg is a highly secretive deep state clique, formed in Holland in 1954. It meets annually at the most exclusive resorts, bringing together former and current government finance ministers, former and current NATO and other military heads, high technology gurus, futurists, select royalty, top corporate titans, think tankers, central bankers, and current and former legislators. It also includes carefully vetted media that participate in the Bilderberg meetings but honor their pledge not to report on the proceedings. The meetings are surrounded by heavily armed private security guards and police forces. No other think tank or private consortium behaves in this manner. Notably, there's preliminary evidence that Bilderberg will return to the U.S. this year, possibly to meet in Virginia, as it did in 2012. As of this writing, that location is not confirmed. Rockefeller, who co-founded the Trilateral Commission in 1973, died the very day the House Select Committee on Intelligence began probing whether Trump campaign officials colluded with any Russians. The committee is seeking to confirm whether Russia indirectly hacked the Democratic National Committee's emails as well as those of John Podesta when he headed up Hillary Clinton's campaign for president. The apparent end goal is to prove that Donald Trump would not have won the 2016 election without Russia hacking emails and using the information to discredit Hillary Clinton and help ensure her loss. Most of the committee's members, gathering the spotty testimony of FBI Director James Comey and NSA Director Mike Rogers, are alleging that private citizens, such as former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, longtime Republican strategist Roger Stone, and several others, in some manner colluded with Russia to discredit Clinton and to influence U.S. policy toward Russia prior to Trump's inauguration. Ironically, the Bilderberg meetings, which the late Rockefeller was so instrumental in advancing, have for the last 63 years provided a perfect platform for U.S. citizens and government officials to curry favor, make deals, and share information with various current and former foreign government officials, central bankers, and high-level corporate heads from several nations, behind closed doors. Interestingly, the Logan Act, a 1798 U.S. law that prohibits U.S. citizens from engaging in private deal-making and diplomacy with foreign officials, has been dusted off by Intelligence Committee members, who claim that some Trump allies have broken that law. As AFP has established after decades following Bilderberg, it'd be much safer to say that the Bilderberg Consortium has routinely skirted or broken the Logan Act. But when AFP contacted the FBI, CIA, and other federal agencies in writing 4 years ago about Bilderberg's intrigues, and to find out whether U.S. tax dollars helped U.S. officials attend Bilderberg meetings, rather cryptic replies, professing utter denial of Bilderberg's significance, arrived in AFP's mailbox, even though the CIA itself played a role in Bilderberg's formation. Rockefeller was clearly aware that key media outlets involved in Bilderberg's deep state matrix, outlets that today are out for blood regarding the Trump White House, have long aided and abetted international intrigue and private collusion via their connection to the powerful global group. Indeed, long before claims about fake news surfaced, Rockefeller, during the 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Baden-Baden, Germany, was reported to have said, "We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subjected to the lights of publicity during those years. But the world is more sophisticated and prepared to march toward a world government." While Rockefeller presided over the Bilderberg-connected Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, think tank in the 70s and 80s, and while he remained a highly honored and influential CFR apparatchik for the rest of his life, this and other admissions of his showed that the real collusion, the kind that the FBI and NSA should truly take an interest in, has been happening in an ongoing fashion among globalist cliques and is hardly limited to whoever's in the White House. As Rockefeller later wrote in his dull tome, Memoirs, some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. Populists gain in Dutch elections, Party for Freedom wins 20 seats in Parliament, immigration issue will be addressed by Ronald Del Rey. The globalists are terrified. They thought they had killed off people's will to rebel against their new world order and that they could move unopposed toward total tyranny. But in country after country in the West, growing numbers of ordinary citizens are awakening to the threat. Devotion to one's country and culture in the face of massive, unassimilable, often criminal immigrant hordes is a growing phenomenon. And after Brexit and President Donald Trump's electoral victory, all eyes are on Europe's elections and the increasing populist threat. On March 15, the Dutch moved one small step closer to reclaiming the Netherlands for their own. The current Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, and pro-European Union, EU, forces try to spin the outcome as a great victory over the wrong kind of populism, as Rutte called it. But the reality is much different and indicates the changing face of European politics. Heading into the election, nationalist Geert Wilders's Party for Freedom, PVV, looked to be leading in opinion polls, but that momentum stalled just a few days before the vote. While many had hoped for or feared a PVV plurality in the parliament, typically, no party gets more than 20% to 30% of the vote. That plurality was elusive. But what did happen was still extremely positive from the nationalist populist viewpoint. When the votes were officially released on March 21, Rutte's ruling People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, VVD, obtained 33 seats in the parliament, 21.2%, a win, but a significant actual loss of 8 seats. After the 2012 election, the VVD was able to form a center-left coalition with the left-wing Labour Party alone, but the latter's collapse, after a massive loss of 29 seats and only 7th place in 2017, means the VVD will have to form a coalition with at least 3 other parties, including at least one of the radical left. Not an easy task, since 76 seats are required for a majority, and no party will enter into coalition with the allegedly extreme right-wing PVV. Wilders's PVV party is really just a center-right party, but with a nationalist, anti-EU slant that is anathema to the European and Dutch establishment. Despite the party's Euroscepticism and opposition to continued foreign, particularly Muslim, invasion, Wilders is disturbingly pro-Zionist and pro-Israel, so, even a future PVV government would likely remain beholden to international banksters and the Jewish terrorist government occupying Palestine. Still, the PVV is much more in line with traditional nation statehood and true representation of what is best for the people. This was recognized by the Dutch themselves, as the PVV came in at a strong second with 20 seats, 13.1%, a one-third gain of 5. If the trend continues, it could become the majority party by 2022, as the discredited internationalist, old-line, pro-EU parties continue to lose the trust of the Dutch people. The Christian Democratic Appeal and Democrat 66 came in third, with 19 seats each, respective gains of 6 and 7. They are likely coalition partners with Rutte's VVD. One of the most telling wins was that of the Green Left, which more than tripled its representation at 14 seats. Its extreme leftist views demonstrate an increasing polarization in Dutch political views, signaling a strong anti-establishment trend among voters. Also significant was the fact that the right-wing Forum for Democracy, another anti-EU, anti-immigrant party, organized just last September, impressively obtained 2 seats, 1.2%, in the Dutch parliament. More importantly, Prime Minister Rutte's party was only able to win by emulating some of Wilders's positions, by telling immigrants to act normal or get out, and refusing to allow a Turkish diplomat to campaign among Turks in the Netherlands for Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Rutte was able to give the appearance of being tough on foreign invaders. The moves were largely symbolic, however, although Turkey has sought to escalate the diplomatic flap, current events in Europe may not wait for the slow shift in popular politics. However, even as media focus moves to upcoming presidential and parliamentary elections in France and Germany, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu declared Rutte's center-leftists no different than Wilders's fascists, according to Sputnik News. He predicted, or called for, jihad in Europe. "You have begun to collapse Europe. Holy wars will soon begin in Europe." Erdogan is also pushing Muslims to undermine European governments. In addition, another, more severe financial crisis is looming, as banks in 10 of 28 EU countries have bad loans, which comprise 10% to 50% of total indebtedness, over 1 trillion euros EU-wide. These non-performing loans have brought numerous banks to the verge of collapse, leading banksters to seek new schemes to offload their bad debt onto governments and make taxpayers further responsible for the financial pharaoh's losses. Instead of abandoning the usury system, which creates these problems, government odying to the money masters could well lead to both fewer, more centralized banks and a breakup of the EU, if consequently impoverished masses rebel against the proposed super bailouts of irresponsible banksters. Fake news outlet lying by omission. Leftist media trying to smear politicians who utter politically incorrect truths as bigots, by Dave Gahlery. A six-sentence article published by the Associated Press, AP, early this month provides great insight into the so-called news reporting in the U.S. It is a cautionary tale for those content with reading what comes across the wire without analyzing it and allowing those sentences to go unchallenged. AP is a New York City-based independent, not-for-profit news cooperative owned by newspapers and radio and television stations that contribute stories, then license the content from AP. Articles and videos from AP are disseminated by over 1,700 newspapers and 5,000 radio and television broadcasters, with 263 locations worldwide operating in 106 countries and a reporter in every U.S. state house. AP is massive, putting out over 2,000 stories a day as well as 1 million photos and 50,000 videos per year. Founded in 1846 by 5 daily New York City newspapers for the purpose of sharing the cost of covering the Mexican-American War, AP's revenue for 2015 came in at over $500 million. Significantly, AP was sued by the U.S. in 1945. With the Supreme Court ruling that AP violated the Sherman Antitrust Act by barring member newspapers from selling or providing news to non-member organizations, as well as making it very difficult for non-member newspapers to join AP, so powerful has AP been in its nearly 171-year history that reporters from the club were almost always the U.S. presidential press secretary's first pick during White House briefings. Although President Donald Trump's White House press secretary and communications director, Sean M. Spicer, also currently a commander in the U.S. Navy Reserve, has so far not called on AP for the first question, opting instead to entertain queries from right-leaning and relatively unknown news outlets. In fact, the first business day of the new administration, January 23, saw Spicer calling on a reporter from the New York Post, established in 1801 by Alexander Hamilton, upsetting the mainstream fake news media by disrupting the pecking order. The AP article alluded to at the start of this report is titled "Maine Governor Apologizes for Past Racially Charged Comments," and due to its short length, is reproduced and dissected below. Yarmouth, Maine, AP, Maine Governor Paul LePage has apologized to a black father for his previous racially charged comments, drawing applause from the crowd at a town hall meeting. Garrett Stewart told the white Republican governor Wednesday in Yarmouth that criticism of civil rights leader John Lewis and comments about black drug dealers coming to Maine were hurtful to his children. LePage responded by saying, "I apologize to you and your children." The self-described straight-talking governor faced widespread criticism last year when he said out-of-state black and Hispanic drug dealers were coming to Maine and impregnating young, white girls. He has said he meant to say Maine women. LePage also insulted Lewis after the Democratic Georgia congressman questioned the legitimacy of Donald Trump's election, and the governor rejected a call from the NAACP to apologize. Identifying the agenda of the fake news media requires studying not just the overall message of the news but each sentence, and even the individual words chosen. By starting out with Maine Governor Paul LePage has apologized to a black father for his previous racially charged comments, drawing applause from the crowd at a town hall meeting, AP puts Maine's governor on the defensive for an offense not stated and forced to apologize. While a crowd erupts in applause, what were the racially charged comments? The next sentence explains that the black father was upset with the white Republican governor's criticism of civil rights leader John Lewis and LePage's comments about black drug dealers coming to Maine. A bit of research reveals that at a 2016 town hall meeting, the conservative governor had said drug dealers come from Connecticut and New York, they come up here, they sell their heroin, they go back home. Incidentally, half the time they impregnate a young, white girl before they leave, which is a real sad thing because then we have another issue we have to deal with down the road. After being attacked by the usual suspects for his candid remarks, LePage revealed that over 90% of the people in a binder he had been compiling of drug arrestees are black and Hispanic people. When the fake news media asked LePage to produce the binder, he replied, "Let me tell you something, black people come up the highway and they kill Mainers. You ought to look into that. You make me so sick." So although LePage's comments had some merit, they were completely ignored by AP. And what of LePage insulting civil rights leader John Lewis? Rep. John Robert Lewis, Democrat, Georgia, was one of the people who organized the 1963 March on Washington, but that certainly doesn't make him a leader. In fact, completely ignored by AP is the fact that Lewis insulted our current president, and all of those who are happy to see a pro-American, real leader in the White House, by stating in an interview on January 14 with NBC's Meet the Press, "I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president." Lewis also refused to attend the inauguration. "It will be the first one that I miss since I've been in Congress. You cannot be at home with something that you feel that is wrong, is not right." Whatever LePage actually said about or to Lewis, that was not deemed newsworthy enough for AP to include LePage's actual words. The reader is left with nothing but an assumption that Lee Page's comments were, in fact, insulting. The self-appointed arbiter of fake news, college professor's news source analysis is poorly researched, full of bias. Melissa Zimders is an assistant professor of communication at Catholic Merrimack College. She is also a self-described feminist activist and Forever Wisconsinite, an online resource of websites some of which she alleges provide false, misleading, clickbaity, and/or satirical news, although originally created for her students. When Dr. Zimders publicized the information on Facebook, it went viral, spreading like the common cold. Corporate mainstream media, MSM, and liberals love it, since it reflects their biases, but the important question is whether the list is true and accurate or itself poorly researched and misleading fake news. Dr. Zimders lists, or blacklists, American Free Press as a questionable news source, supposedly because of extreme bias and conspiracy theories, but we contacted her by email, anyway, since we believe primary sources are always the best for reporting stories. We sent her a list of 10 questions about her project, and she responded promptly but declined to answer all but a couple of the simplest. I don't have time to thoroughly answer all of these questions. The young college professor is passionate about her subject and believes she is helping her impressionable students. She also makes some valid criticisms of how today's news is created and reported, even in the MSM. In fact, a number of the websites on her list are clearly a bit bizarre and designed more for data mining and advertising revenue than for news. But while Dr. Zimder states, "I include several left-leaning and far-left sources," we saw fewer than 10 out of hundreds presented. Apart from the large number of oddball sites we would avoid ourselves, there is a similarly large number of extremely reliable conservative, populist, nationalist, and health websites, which Dr. Zimders tars with epithets like fake news, conspiracy theory, extreme bias, junk science, hate news, and clickbait. The last describes sites that use provocative headlines to keep readers looking at more of their, or their advertisers', stories. Dr. Zimders is defensive. "This resource is definitely not a blacklist. I do not encourage any stifling or censoring of speech. Even outright fake news is protected speech. There is a difference between blacklisting speech and analyzing speech. I am engaged in the latter, but that rings hollow." She further defends the list by referring on Twitter to a WGBH.org article claiming political polarization is mainly a right-wing phenomenon. The article is the epitome of the fake news Dr. Zimders excoriates. A secondary source employing a false and misleading headline and unsubstantiated content. Did she actually breed it? Digging the hole deeper, in criticizing one of her critics, she linked not to an original article on WorldNetDaily.com, but to its reposting on ZeroHedge.com, a site providing generally well-substantiated news and analysis, which she claims promotes conspiracy theories, as though conspiracy theories, or facts, are in themselves bad. Dr. Zimders is blacklist, for such it really is, since its use with caution premise is clearly disparaging and designed to discourage use of sites listed as not credible, demonstrates the far-left ideological biases of its compiler. For example, although teaching at a Catholic college, she is openly pro-abortion and carries that baby hate into her listing decisions. Highly reputable life site news is criticized for clickbait and extreme bias. Project Veritas is tagged with unreliable and extreme bias, despite its great undercover exposés of abortionists. Black Genocide.org, a religious, pro-life site exposing the disproportionate genocide of Black Americans through abortion by Planned Parenthood and others, is denigrated for hate news, extreme bias, and conspiracy theories. Does Dr. Zimder support Black Genocide? Health website Natural News, a particular bogeyman for Dr. Zimders, is tainted for junk science and conspiracy theories. Paul Craig Roberts' org is blacklisted for bias and conspiracy, while the increasingly worthless, perversion-pushing news aggregator, Drudge Report, is still guilty of extreme bias. Even WikiLeaks, the epitome of investigative, primary source journalism, is tagged as unreliable. Dr. Zimders's shortlist of 19 credible news sources almost exclusively includes establishment corporate, Zionist-controlled MSM, like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, because they allegedly follow traditional journalistic vetting norms. No mention of their connections to the Bilderberg elitists or their fronting for the CIA, and scant attention to their frequent reporting of false facts. Ultimately, Dr. Zimders is, perhaps unwittingly, a shill for the deep state corporate media myrmidons. The net effect of her so-called resources to trash without proof even the best of the alternative media in an effort to steer people back toward the rightly discredited MSM. She operates naively from a false premise that traditional news sources in the corporatocracy generally follow reliable norms of veracity. The professor's own ideological worldview unconscionably hampers her objectivity. A review of her blacklisted, not credible websites reveals that she and her assistants have failed to engage in thorough objective review and analysis of the sites she disparages. While containing some helpful information, Dr. Zimders's open sources code provides no guarantee of accuracy or reliability, a telling admission. It is itself false, misleading, fake news. By contrast, you can trust AFP for well-researched, provocative reporting, which gets to the truth ignored or hidden by mainstream media prostitutes. Truth is the enemy of state control. Academia, media, government, courts, historians, economists suppressing the truth. The Constitution applies to U.S. citizens, and the amendments known as the Bill of Rights guarantee due process as a protection of U.S. citizen civil liberties. That's the theory, but not the practice. Trump's travel ban applies to non-U.S. citizens, primarily to refugees from the Bush-Obama bombings of numerous Muslim countries. Some of these refugees, whose families and countries were destroyed by American troops, could harbor feelings of revenge against Americans. The Ninth Circuit panel's injunction against Trump's executive order gives the Constitution's protection of U.S. citizens to non-citizens, apparently on the basis of due process and religious discrimination arguments. The panel of judges said that Trump's executive order runs contrary to the fundamental structure of our constitutional democracy. So too does bombing numerous Muslim countries over the course of the past 16 years, about which nothing has been done. One would think that, with the Democratic Party's merger with identity politics and with the liberal progressive left leaning of the Ninth Circuit, more of a stink would have been raised about bombing Muslims gratuitously than on placing a mere ban on their entry into the U.S. But it all depends on who does the bombing and who does the ban. Identity politics requires America's first black president to be supported at all costs, and Trump, a white, heterosexual, male billionaire, to be hated at all costs. Dear readers, note that the U.S. federal courts roll out the Constitution in order to protect non-citizens from a president's executive order preventing their entry into the U.S., but refuse to protect the constitutional rights of American citizens from arbitrary indefinite detention and execution without due process. The fact that constitutional rights no longer apply to citizens, only to non-citizens, has evoked no comment from the liberal progressive left, from the Democratic Party, from Harvard Law School, from the American Bar Association, or from the Federalist Society. Not from anyone. And for my reward for telling the truth, Harvard University Library has published a large list of false, misleading, clickbait-y, and satirical news sources on which Paul Craig Roberts' org is included. Harvard's library does not say where the list came from or why the list is credible. I am on the list for bias and conspiracy, but bias means that I do not accept the ruling establishment's self-serving explanations, and conspiracy means that I report on the findings of the 3,000 high-rise architects and structural engineers who comprise Architects and Engineers for 9-11 Truth, the Firefighters for 9-11 Truth, Pilots for 9-11 Truth, and the Scientists for 9-11 Truth, all of whom are far more knowledgeable about 9. 11th and the Harvard librarian or the Harvard faculty, Americans, and apparently Harvard's library, are unaware that hardly any of the experts who have chosen to speak out about the official 9-11 story, including those first responders inside the two towers, believe a word of the official story. Harvard's librarians are apparently so ill-read that they are unfamiliar with books by the 9-11 Commission's chairman, vice chairman and legal counsel, who wrote that information was withheld from the 9-11 Commission and that the commission was set up to fail. Harvard's librarian is apparently unfamiliar with the testimony of demolition experts that the buildings came down as a result of controlled demolition. Harvard's librarian is apparently ignorant of the panel of scientists headed by a University of Copenhagen nanochemist who reported finding both reacted and unreacted nanothermite in the dust of the Twin Towers and who offered their samples for confirmation by other scientists. Harvard University has no interest in truth. Harvard's sole interest is to remain a member of the ruling establishment. As that requires telling lies, Harvard will tell lies. Lies bring Harvard riches, making Harvard so rich that, as Ron Unz argues, Harvard does not need to charge tuition and does so only out of greed. Decades ago, my University of California, Berkeley economics professor became Dean of Arts and Sciences at Harvard. My term paper for the course had been published in the prestigious journal Classica et Medievalia. Years later, when he learned that my book, The Supply-Side Revolution, had passed the peer review process of Harvard University Press and was slated for publication, he sent for me. He said that he wanted to have me appointed to the Harvard Economics faculty, because the university's belief in econometrics had proven false and the economics faculty needed a broad-based person such as myself to bring the subject back to life in the real world. I wished him good luck and wondered how a dean this naive had survived at Harvard. For the dean at Harvard, my work was a strong point. I was the first to explain the Soviet economy both as an organizational system and in terms of the original Marxist aspirations. I had reformulated the Pyrrhon thesis, and my reformulation had been included into reading text used in courses in medieval history and urban economics. I had produced new insights into economic policy and had identified regulation as a factor of production. My macroeconomic contributions had corrected the Keynesian deficiencies and extended the role of relative prices into macroeconomics. This seminal work had passed the peer review process of Harvard University Press and resulted in the publication of my book, The Supply-Side Revolution, recently republished in the Chinese language in China, but still derided by American ignoramuses as trickle-down economics. Harvard University Press kept the supply-side revolution in print for decades. Despite this fact, even people I highly respect, such as Michael Hudson and Louis Lapham, have no idea what supply-side economics is about and misrepresent it as some kind of preferment for the rich, which shows the power of the establishment to control the understanding of even highly intelligent people. To get back to the story, my appointment to Harvard's economic faculty was blocked by the economics department's resistance on the basis that I was too disruptive of the orthodoxy. Me and Michael Hudson, the orthodoxy has a large investment in human capital in protecting the rights of the 1% to plunder the rest of us. Those academics who support this plunder are the ones who prosper in the American Academy, just as the prostitutes who lie for a living do in the American media. So here I am, a peer-reviewed and published Harvard University Press author and peer-reviewed Oxford University Press author, whose books are now available in Chinese, 2, Russian, German, 3, Czech, Turkish, French, Spanish, 2, and Korean. A person who has held the highest security clearances and once had subpoena power over the CIA, who has the French Legion of Honor, who has the U.S. Treasury's Silver Medal, who has letters of thanks from President Reagan for my contributions to U.S. economic policy, who is asked to speak all over the world, who was Senior Research Fellow, Hoover Institution, Stanford University for decades, the William E. Simon Chair of Political Economy, Center for Strategic and International Studies, Georgetown University for 12 years, Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, associate editor of The Wall Street Journal, columnist for Business Week and the Scripps Howard News Service, etc., and so on. And some dummy at the Harvard Library posts a list that says I am a suspect source of information. This is the world we live in. Even the most prestigious institutions are utterly corrupt. No one is there for the American people or for truth, or for anything or anyone except the 1%. Americans are shot down in the streets, whites along with blacks, by militarized police trained to see the people who pay their salaries as enemies. Muslims are bombed into the Stone Age. Reformist Latin American governments are routinely overthrown. European countries are intimidated, bribed, and reduced to vassal status. Aggression is displayed toward Russia, China, and Iran. America has become a great collection of evil. The good in the country is voiceless and without power. Evil rules us. I don't have to write. My writing brings me insults from narcissistic, ignorant egomaniacs, puts me on blacklists, makes overseas travel difficult, and possibly negatively impacts my relatives. The United States has devolved into a police state where truth is the enemy of the state, which makes me suspect. After jailing crooked bankers, Iceland's economy is roaring. By Dave Gahlery. After prosecuting banksters and corrupt politicians in the fallout of widespread protests of the Nordic countries' October 2008 economic collapse, Iceland has regained its financial footing. The government declared on March 14 that financial stability had been restored and it was ending its long-standing restrictions on the flow of money into and out of the country, signifying its return to international financial markets. The miracle of Iceland. Population 332,529, reported regularly in the pages of this newspaper, is a story of the common man taking on the robber barons and winning. The backlash against the financial machinations almost a decade ago was so fierce that not only were nearly 100 bankers and politicians targeted for prosecution, but Iceland's Prime Minister, Geir Hilmar Hard, was forced out of office, becoming the first sitting minister of that country indicted for misconduct. Hard was found guilty of failing to adequately inform other Icelandic officials of events that led up to the 2008 financial crisis, reported this newspaper in 2012. Although Hard spent no time behind bars, the backlash against the plutocrats was indicative of Iceland's re-establishment of its sovereignty after defaulting on the bankers, wrote American Free Press. Iceland's economy expanded over 7% in 2016, all the more remarkable considering its three main banks failed and its currency and economy fell into a tailspin, as reported in the New York Times on March 14. After imposing financial controls, which stopped foreign investors from yanking their money out and destroying the economy, Iceland is now worried about the risks of overheating and inflation. While the unemployment rate has plummeted to 2.6%, a near-record low, rampant wage increases are crimping productivity and may encourage inflation, states the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the 35-member Intergovernmental Economic Organization whose goal is to stimulate economic progress and world trade. At the time of the 2008 collapse, Iceland's three biggest banks' combined assets were an astonishing 14 times larger than the country's economic output. Chafing under a withering $85 billion of debt, foreigners own such a huge chunk of that figure that allowing them to take assets out would risk severely devaluing Iceland's currency, the krona, reported the Times. With the krona devalued, reported the Times, tourism took off much faster than other new ventures because visitors could see the northern lights and the rugged Icelandic landscape at a steep discount. Tourism is now Iceland's biggest industry, recently overtaking fishing and, perhaps not surprisingly, banking, with nearly 2 million visitors a year pumping over $3 billion into the economy in 2015, a remarkable third of the country's export earnings. In fact, 10% of Icelanders work in the tourism industry, the country's single largest employer. Iceland's stunning comeback stands in stark contrast to that of Greece, which has been foundering since Athens imposed controls on capital in 2015 as the country seemed to be veering toward dumping the euro. Although some restrictions were eased, they are mostly expected to remain in place for the foreseeable future. Sadly, for the Hellenic Republic, economists have little hope that the birthplace of democracy will recover, as it continues to labor under huge debt in its third international financial rescue program in 7 years. Advertisement: The Bilderbergers, Puppet Masters of Power, an investigation into claims of conspiracy at the heart of politics, business and the media. Since 1954, a discreet and select group of wealthy and powerful individuals have attended a private, yearly conference to discuss matters of their choosing. This group represents European and North American elites, as well as new talent and rising stars, from the world of politics, business, media, academia, the military and even royalty, and has included household names such as Margaret Thatcher, Henry Kissinger, and Prince Philip. In recent years, their numbers have featured David Cameron, Tony Blair, Angela Merkel, Bill Clinton, and David Rockefeller. They are the Bilderbergers, named for the hotel in the Netherlands where their secret gatherings were first hosted. Investigative writer Gerhard Wisniewski explores the numerous claims of conspiracy that swirl around the group, revealing names of participants, their agendas, and their goals. The scene opens in the sun-kissed seaside resort of Valiakmini, Greece, where Wisniewski tries to observe and report on a Bilderberg conference. He soon attracts aggressive, unwanted attention from police and undercover security, and it is made abundantly clear he is not welcome. From this rude introduction, Wisniewski works backward to the founding of the Bilderbergers in 1954 by a shadowy Jesuit with Secret Service allegiances. Examining records and hidden reports, the author uncovers the true history of the organization, alliances among key individuals, and their common interests. Soft cover, 288 pages, $25. Add $4 S&H inside the U.S., outside the U.S. email bookstore, at americanfreepress.net for S&H. Send request with payment to AFP, 16,000 Trade Zone Avenue, Unit 406, Upper Marlboro, Maryland 20,774, or call 1-888-699-6397 toll-free to charge or visit www.americanfreepress.net. Google censoring your searches. Army of 10,000 contractors flags, suppresses offensive material. By Dave Gahlery, the most visited website in the world, whose unofficial slogan was Don't Be Evil until it was replaced by Do the Right Thing, is certainly not doing the right thing and is also acting quite evil. Google, the U.S. multinational technology company best known for its ubiquitous, eponymous search engine, is in a new business, tagging the internet search results of alternative views of the historical event known as the Holocaust. But it's not just Holocaust revisionists Google's after, but all haters, white supremacists, and racists, or at least trying to ensure that internet searches do not end up at websites Google has classified as such. The UK's Guardian reported on March 15, Google is using a 10,000-strong army of independent contractors to flag offensive or upsetting content, in order to ensure that queries like Did the Holocaust Happen don't push users to misinformation, propaganda, and hate speech. Although Google's contractors have been utilizing a manual, titled Search Quality Rating Guidelines, at least since 2013, describing every potential problem they could find with a given search query, a new update to the book orders the censors to flag search results that could be upsetting or offensive to web servers. Speaking of whiners, NBC News interviewed head whiner of the hopelessly corrupt Southern Poverty Law Center, Heidi Beerich, who moaned to Google a few months ago to update its algorithm to remove a result from a neo-Nazi website questioning whether the Holocaust happened. She told the fake news outlet about Google, "They're moving away from self-reporting, relying on the public to tell you where there's problems, and they are talking about a systematic policy. The new system will not affect search results, but will, according to Google, be used by Google to help judge the success of algorithm changes and to train its machine learning systems. That's right, artificial intelligence systems that ban human critical thinking. Google, already scorned for its abuse of privacy, tax avoidance, antitrust behavior, censorship, and search neutrality, has been under additional pressure lately by critics claiming that its searches promote extremist content. The UK's Guardian and Observer published a series of articles promoting this view recently, as well as complaining that it fails to keep fake news and propaganda off the top of search results. Of course, fake news is in the eye of the beholder. Founded in 1996 and valued last year at over $133 billion, Google is now the largest subsidiary of Alphabet Incorporated, which has acquired over 200 companies since last December. Alphabet's most well-known brand besides Google is YouTube, the video-sharing tech company, acquired in 2006. YouTube is also notorious for its censorship of videos that threaten the powers that be. It certainly is a brave, new world we are all on the precipice of, one that rejects free expression and personal responsibility and where those who cry the loudest prevail. Monsanto lawsuit exposes dark secrets. Court documents show incestuous links between agri-giant and government regulators. Will documents from a lawsuit involving Monsanto provide the smoking goo of the dangers of Roundup, the megacorporation's best-selling herbicide? Documents released as a result of lawsuits filed in federal district court in San Francisco, where multiple plaintiffs with non-Hodgkin lymphoma sued Monsanto on the grounds that exposure to its herbicide Roundup brought on cancer, reveal insight into how cozy federal agencies are with the companies they are supposed to regulate. Judge Vince Chabria, a federal judge for the Northern District of California in San Francisco, allowed documents to be released that confirm regulators do not work for the people but for Monsanto, as has long been believed by those who suspect Monsanto has deep ties to regulators. In addition, so-called independent academics who vouch for Roundup safety may not be so independent after all, the documents reveal. Monsanto's lawyers worked overtime to have all documents sealed, hidden from public examination. But Chabria, a San Francisco native appointed to the bench by President Obama, warned Monsanto lawyers on February 27 that documents obtained in discovery, a legal process whereby parties are required to reveal records, will be made public. Chabria cautioned Monsanto's lawyers that they may be sanctioned if they attempt to skirt discovery. Veteran journalist Carrie Gillum, affiliated with the consumer advocacy group U.S. Right to Know, quoted Chabria's ruling, "I have a problem with Monsanto, because it is insisting that stuff be filed under seal that should not be filed under seal. Documents relevant to the litigation, they shouldn't be under seal, even if they are embarrassing to Monsanto, you know, even if Monsanto doesn't like what they say," Chabria said. Ms. Gillum wrote, "Monsanto attorney Eric Lasker complained to the judge that the plaintiff's attorneys are trying to try the case in litigation and the press." She quoted Lasker as saying, "This is litigation that people are following, that what happens in this courtroom ends up on blogs, posts, ends up in articles. God forbid the public actually knows how Monsanto interacts with the very agencies we pay to protect us from environmental assault." The documents revealed clear collusion between Monsanto and the agency, as even the New York Times, which is no stranger to whitewashing the truth, confirmed on March 15. Roughly 2 years ago, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, affiliated with the World Health Organization, made the determination that glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, was a probable carcinogen and likely a factor in causing non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Records released by Chabria revealed a whopper. Monsanto was tipped off to the IARC's finding months beforehand by Jess Rowland, a deputy director at the Environmental Protection Agency, according to The Times. This gave Monsanto the opportunity to launch a public relations snow job, which it did, with all of its lapdogs in the mainstream media smugly muddying up the waters of truth. As if that's not bad enough, Roland promised to quash an effort by the Department of Health and Human Services to review glyphosate safety, according to The Times, which quoted Dan Jenkins, a Monsanto executive, as saying that Roland bragged, "If I can kill this, I should get a medal." Jenkins suggested to another colleague that Roland was planning to retire and could be useful as we move forward with ongoing glyphosate defense, according to The Times. One can't imagine a more obvious revolving door between behemoth and government. As for the charge that Roundup critics are anti-science know-nothings who seek out discredited academics to confirm our bias against Monsanto, the documents reveal that Monsanto may unduly influence research that alleges its products are safe. Monsanto executive William Haydens told colleagues they could ghostwrite research on glyphosate by paying academics to sign off on science generated by Monsanto itself. Haydens was quoted in an unsealed email in The Times, "We would be keeping the cost down by us doing the writing and they would just edit and sign their names, so to speak." To hear Monsanto's propaganda machine, you'd think anyone who questions the safety of glyphosate may as well deny gravity. But in fact, the issue is hotly debated by prominent scientists who are not on Monsanto's payroll, or who are vying for positions and using their academic research as resumes. Lawyer Robin Greenwald of Weitz & Luxembourg, who is representing the cancer victim plaintiffs, told The Times, "People should know that there are superb scientists in the world who would disagree with Monsanto and some of the regulatory agencies' evaluations, and even EPA has disagreement within the agency. Even in the EU, there's been a lot of disagreement among the countries. It's not so simple as Monsanto makes it out to be. It's not so simple as Monsanto and hacks would of us believe. And, what is even more not so simple is the question of causation, what role Roundup plays in the development of cancer, which is the essence of the litigation. It's too soon to tell if the current or future document release will reveal a smoking gun of causation, but we can hope that truth will win out and the case will not be compromised by the powers that be." Advertisement. You asked for it, you got it. Michael Collins Piper's Final Judgment is back in a new two-volume set. Here's the two-volume book set that ties together all the various conspiracy theories by exposing the missing link, Israel's Mossad. When first published, Piper was called a lunatic and a hater for daring to suggest the one thing that all the various JFK assassination conspiracy theories lacked, the thread that bound them all together. After decades of research, beginning as a young man, Piper, through meticulous research and voluminous reading, finally was able to do what no other JFK researcher before or since has been able to do, solve the crime. This is Piper's magnum opus, and is still gaining in popularity even today. Stretching from the heartland of America to the seat of power in the Middle East, Piper proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Israel, with the blessing of its then Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, was able to pull off the crime of the century. This book answers almost every question you have ever had about the crime of the 20th century, the who, what, when, where and how of the crime. Piper names the important names and takes you along on an investigative journey like no other JFK assassination volume you have ever read before. Now complete with a new foreword written by Mike's good friend and fellow JFK researcher, Ray Goodwin of Texas. If you don't own Final Judgment, you need to get this two-volume set. Volume 1 is 428 pages, including more than 35 pages of rare photos. Volume 2 is 372 pages and includes all 10 original, must-read appendices. There are gems in these appendices you just don't want to overlook. Here within these pages is the epitome of JFK conspiracy research. Together, these two indexed volumes are available for $40 plus $5 S&H inside the U.S. Send $40 payment with request to AFP, 16,000 Trade Zone Avenue, Unit 406, Upper Marlboro, Maryland 20,774, include $5 S&H in the U.S. Books are in stock and ready to be shipped outside the U.S. email bookstore at American Free Press, .net for foreign S&H. Call 1-888-699-6307. Toll free to charge. Order online at www.americanfreepress.net. Rape of Ninth Grade Girl Highlights Insanity of Safe Haven Policies, by John Friend. When President Donald Trump announced his bid for the presidency in June of 2015, he made headlines by making illegal immigration one of the main focuses of his campaign. He described the millions of illegal immigrants currently residing in the U.S. as having lots of problems, and said they are bringing drugs and crime to America. He also said some of them are rapists. His controversial remarks sparked outrage and hysteria among Democrats and leftist activists, who characterized Trump's rational stance on illegal immigration as racist, discriminatory, and bigoted. Capital A. Recent tragic news story in Maryland, however, has proven just how prescient Trump's bold remarks have proven to be. Two illegal aliens have been arrested and charged with the vicious rape of a 14-year-old girl in Montgomery County, Maryland, which sits adjacent to our nation's capital. The two young men illegally residing in the U.S., identified as Henry Sanchez, 18, of Guatemala and Jose Montano, 17, of El Salvador, were placed in the ninth grade at Rockville High School as a direct result of liberal policies sanctioned by countless state and local governments across America. Sanchez and Montano approached the young victim in the hallway, asking her to have sex. When the young victim refused, Sanchez and Montano forced her into the boys' bathroom, where they proceeded to rape her in a bathroom stall. The two young men were arrested at school later that day. According to reports, Montano denied raping the young victim when asked by police about the allegations. However, forensic evidence found in the bathroom and presented in court documents make clear a rape did take place. William Gein, president of Americans for Legal Immigration PAC, is thankful this horrific story is gaining national media attention. Gein, a strong critic of illegal immigration, argues tragic stories like this rarely make the national or even local news given how detrimental they are to the prevailing leftist narrative that illegal immigrants are simply looking for a better life and more opportunities. It's a miracle that anyone is even hearing about this case, because first the victim had to report the crime, and a lot of crimes like this do not get reported, Gein recently stated. Secondly, once it was reported, it had to make it out of a school system. And quite often, schools suppress the sharing of information like this, and then you have to get past the local media, which often strives to conceal the crime altogether, or to conceal the immigration status of the perpetrator. The story has gained national attention, forcing the spotlight on the issue of illegal immigration once again, and has many Americans outraged at the open borders and sanctuary policies enacted by local, state, and federal politicians, which put young children and innocent Americans at risk. These young men obviously had no fear of law enforcement, Gein argues. They come from lands where there is no law enforcement, and they show they can come here and break laws with impunity, so why should they fear any boundaries, be they national or sexual boundaries? We hope that this unfortunate case will inspire President Donald Trump to honor his broken campaign promise to end ACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, amnesty on his first day in office. Amazon Kindle's book Burning Bonfire. Historians burned by powerful interest group pressure are still winning the debate, by Kevin Barrett. Amazon Incorporated is a company that produces nothing yet delivers everything. The ultimate intermediary between producers and consumers, Amazon recently sponsored a Super Bowl ad promising that they will soon be bringing our food, and books and toilet paper and everything else, directly to our doorsteps, or even to our upstairs windows, using a vast fleet of delivery drones. Amazon's patently illegal strategy has been to lose billions of dollars underselling the competition in order to establish a permanent monopoly on virtually everything. Once that monopoly is established, you will either buy and sell through Amazon, at inflated prices, or you will starve. As of early 2017, Amazon has already carved out a virtual monopoly in the online book market. Anyone selling books that question mainstream interpretations of controversial issues, as I do, gets 80% of their sales through Amazon, as bookstores are unlikely to stock our products. My False Flag trilogy consists of three books featuring 55 leading public intellectuals pushing back against the propaganda surrounding recent False Flag terror events. It has been attacked by the President of France, the Anti-Defamation League, and other powerful forces. I was denied entry into Canada for political reasons. After getting that decision reversed, I went on a speaking tour of Canada, only to discover that the hate speech squads of Canadian police departments were sending plainclothes officers to my talks. Then last fall, I was actually banned from speaking in a Unitarian church in Berkeley, California. Why all the fuss? Because my books include essays on the Israeli role in false flag terror. Since I can't get my books into most bookstores, and since my public speaking opportunities are limited by the angry Zionists who make life miserable for anyone who invites me, I depend on Amazon. If they ever decide to ban me, I will have to spend the rest of my life driving around selling books out of the trunk of my car. And now it appears that Amazon has begun banning politically controversial books. In 2015, they axed Jim Fetzer's Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, presumably after complaints from Lenny Posner, who has made a career of harassing Sandy Hook researchers. I assume Posner had credibly threatened a lawsuit. Surely Amazon would not ban books merely because they question the mainstream interpretation of a controversial historical event. But that is exactly what Amazon is now doing. As American Free Press previously reported on its front page in issue 11 and 12, beginning in the first week of March, Amazon has kindled a vast book-burning bonfire. They have disappeared hundreds, perhaps thousands of titles in a purge of anything and everything that falls into the broad, nebulous category of Holocaust revisionism. I spent the first half of my adult life teaching critical thinking at American colleges and universities. I believed what I had been taught, that the American Academy, and American culture in general, is based on free thinking and fearless debate. We Americans believe that the best remedy for bad speech is not censorship, but more and better speech. If you don't like a book, even if you find it profoundly offensive, don't burn it. That simply lends it credibility. Instead, write a better book. Explain, using logic and evidence, why the book you hate is so wrong. Why can't the anti-revisionists do that? The two leading anti-revisionist texts, Deborah Lipstadt's Denial and Shermer and Grobman's Denying History, are grossly inadequate. Can't someone write a better one? If not, and the book burnings continue, the revisionists win the debate by default. 98-year-old man accused of being dangerous mass murdering Nazi, by Matthew Raphael Johnson. Michael Karkok is a 98-year-old American citizen accused of Nazi war crimes. He also has Alzheimer's. Currently, he's accused of participating in the suppression of the Warsaw Uprising in July 1944. While the Allied bombers destroyed civilian centers in Japan and Germany, the Polish government is arguing that the suppression of a riot is a crime. The main driving force is not a Jewish group, but attorney Robert Janicki, head of the main commission for the prosecution of crimes against the Polish nation. The Polish indictment reads, on July 23, 1944, Karkok's company was responsible for the pacification of villages in the Lublin region, including Klaniowo. In retaliation for the killing by Polish partisans of a German liaison officer, as a result, 44 unarmed civilians, including children and babies, were murdered in Klaniowo and in the neighboring village Wolodyslawin. The Ukrainian Self-Defense Legion was a part of the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division of the SSN, comprised of Ukrainian nationals from the western province of Galicia. It was created under the condition that it would exclusively fight the Bolsheviks and not the Western Allies, including Poles. Complicating the issue is that, initially, handwriting samples of the Commander Folkor Wolf did not match Karkok's handwriting, so the Poles went to facial recognition, using grainy photos from the era, which is not a precise method and proves very little. The investigators at the forensic laboratory of the police headquarters in Lublin, as well as the Lublin Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation, have rejected the photographic evidence. According to Michael Melnick's 2007 book, titled To Battle, The Formation and History of the 14th Waffen-SS Grenadier Division, the history of the unit in July 1944 shows them fighting off a massive Soviet attack from the 2nd Soviet Air Army and not in the least involved in pacifying local riots. The division was, on July 21, near the town of Olesko, up against a large number of Soviet tanks commanded by Marshal Ivan Konev. Most of its forces were destroyed in the fighting, though a German panzer counterattack rescued 400 Galicians from the town of Brody, where they were dug in. The Soviets used their overwhelming numbers to destroy the unit by July 22, yet the Polish government wants to indict Karkot for actions against civilians on July 23. The evidence does not add up. The Soviet 91st Independent Tank Brigade Proskurov destroyed the German parts of the division later on July 21. Total losses for the division in this period exceeded 30,000. Karkok did lie to American authorities about fighting for the SS, and with good reason. This is hardly a cause for indictment, though. The Canadian Commission of Inquiry on War Criminals had already cleared this unit of any massacres in 1986. Countering accusations brought by Simon Wiesenthal, the commission stated, "It is obvious that the list of 217 officers of Galicia Division furnished by Mr. Wiesenthal was nearly totally useless and put the Canadian government, through RCMP and this commission, to a considerable amount of purposeless work. That additional information be long in coming may not be surprising, under those circumstances. As a result, evidence of participation in war crimes has remained elusive. None of this makes sense, but the truth does not seem to matter when it comes to these kinds of politically motivated accusations." Mideast mission creep, U.S. increasing, not reducing, global blueprint, by Richard Walker. The Saudis and Israelis want the U.S. to commit more forces and materiel to the Middle East, and all signs are that the Trump administration may be happy to comply. The arrival of more U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, as well as a commitment to the Saudis to get more deeply involved in their military campaign against Yemen's Houthis, could result in the kind of mission creep that has all too often in the past characterized disastrous U.S. involvement in conflicts that have cost American lives and more than $1 trillion, all to no avail. In fact, the Middle East today is a mess, which has resulted in untold numbers of dead on all sides, in part because of U.S. regime change policies under several presidents. Washington has consistently broken promises to the American public by putting troops on the ground across the Middle East, and none of it has ended well. The question facing Americans now is whether President Donald Trump will learn from the mistakes of the past, break with tradition, and keep America out of several critical areas of conflict in the Middle East, in particular Syria and Yemen. Will he avoid being drawn into a major war with Iran, something the Saudis and Israelis are hoping for? The signs that Trump will avoid the blunders of his predecessors do not look promising. Some of the pointers to his future Middle East commitments have already surfaced. When he failed to include Saudi Arabia in his travel ban, it should have been obvious that he planned to reset U.S. relations with the kingdom and therefore its Arab allies. Riyadh is a capital city he knows well from his and his son-in-law Jared Kushner's Arab business ties over many years. Recently, he promised to lift an Obama-era ban on the sale of $200 million of sophisticated weapons to the Saudis. He also indicated that he plans to get more heavily involved in the war in Yemen. Obama played a duplicitous role in the Yemen conflict. While he had U.S. ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, condemned Saudi war crimes against Yemeni civilians, he helped the Saudis run their air war against Yemen's Houthis, which depends heavily on British-American surveillance, bombs, including cluster munitions, and political cover for atrocities. It did not seem to matter to Obama that he risked creating a massive famine in the country or that he emboldened the country's Al-Qaeda branch. More importantly, He got us into a war in Yemen that is ongoing and being ignored by the controlled mainstream media. Donald Trump knows all of this, but he appears ready to build closer links to the Saudis and thus their role in Yemen. Saudi Defense Minister Crown Prince bin Salman declared there had been an historical turning point after meeting Trump at the White House on March 10. The Saudis see Yemen, and this White House's willingness to get more involved in targeting al-Qaeda in that country, as a good thing for the Saudis and Israelis. Yemen represents the road to a bigger objective. For them it is a proxy war against Iran, and if the U.S. gets heavily involved, sooner or later it will lead to a major confrontation with Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Arab leaders wish for nothing more than the U.S. to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age. Elsewhere in the region, additional American troops are being moved into Iraq and Jordan for a future insertion into Syria, where the Trump administration has visions of establishing so-called safe zones, or humanitarian corridors for refugees. With nothing seemingly resolved in Syria, the conflict could also result in mission creep. Israel would like to see that, because it could place U.S. forces in a showdown with Hezbollah forces supporting the Assad-Russia war there. The Middle East has a tendency to suck in U.S. presidents. There are already U.S. forces across the whole region, and with Russia perhaps poised to take on ISIS in Libya, the Trump administration might seek to join that fight, too, in a more concerted fashion. Trump's promise not to be drawn into foreign conflicts, especially in the Middle East, faces opposition in his inner circle. His belief that he can rely on Kushner for the formation of a policy for the region is perhaps naive, if not flawed. Kushner is a personal friend of Netanyahu and has not displayed a vision for keeping us out of wars in that part of the world. Given his history, he is likely to favor Israel's agenda, and as we know from President Ronald Reagan onward, that has major pitfalls for the United States militarily, economically, and in terms of American wounded and lives lost. Who's hijacking Trump's foreign policy? Senator John McCain pushing NATO expansion, confrontation with Russia, Syria, Iran. By Pat Buchanan. What has happened to the foreign policy that Americans voted for on November 8 with the election of Donald Trump, to include peace with Russia, an end to U.S. wars in the Middle East, and having rich allies pay for the cost of their own defense? The senator from Kentucky, said Senator John McCain, Republican, Arizona, speaking of his colleague Senator Rand Paul, is working for Vladimir Putin, and I do not say that lightly. What did Paul do to deserve being called a hireling of Putin? He declined to support McCain's call for a unanimous Senate vote to bring Montenegro into NATO as the 29th member of a Cold War alliance President Donald Trump has called obsolete. Bordered by Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia, Kosovo, and Albania, tiny Montenegro has a population roughly that of DC and sits on the western coast of the most volatile peninsula in Europe. What strategic benefit would accrue from having Montenegro as an ally that would justify the risk of our having to go to war should some neighbor breach Montenegro's borders? Historically, the Balkans have been an incubator of war. In the 19th century, Otto von Bismarck predicted that when the Great War came, it would come out of some damn fool thing in the Balkans, and so it did when the Austrian Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo June 28, 1914 by Serbian ethno-nationalist Gavrilo Princip. Aflame with ethnic, civil, and sectarian war in the 1990s, the Western Balkans are again in political turmoil. Milo Djukanovic, a longtime Montenegrin prime minister who resigned on election day in October, claims that he was targeted for assassination by Russia to prevent Montenegro's accession to NATO. Russia denies it. But on the Senate floor, McCain raged at Rand Paul, "You are achieving the objectives of Vladimir Putin trying to dismember this small country, which has already been the subject of an attempted coup. But if Montenegro, awash in corruption and crime, is on the verge of an uprising or coup, why would the U.S. issue a war guarantee that could vault us into a confrontation with Russia, without a full Senate debate?" The vote that needs explaining here is not Paul's. It is the votes of those senators who are handing out U.S. NATO war guarantees to countries most Americans could not find on a map. Is no one besides Paul asking the relevant questions here? What vital U.S. interest is imperiled in who comes to power in Bajorica, Montenegro? Why cannot Europe handle this neighborhood problem? Has Trump given McCain, who wanted President George W. Bush to intervene in a Russia-Georgia war, over South Ossetia, carte blanche to hand out war guarantees to unstable Balkan states? Did Trump approve the expansion of NATO into all the successor states born of the bloody breakup of Yugoslavia? Or is McCain hijacking U.S. foreign policy on NATO in Russia? Trump should tell the Senate, no more admissions to NATO, no more U.S. war guarantees unless I have recommended or approved them. Foreign policy is made in the White House, not on the Senate floor. Indeed, what happened to the foreign policy America voted for? Rapprochement with Russia, an end to U.S. wars in the Middle East, and having rich allies share more of the cost of their own defense? It is U.S., not NATO, defense spending that is rising to more than $50 billion this year. And today we learn the Pentagon has drawn up plans for the insertion of 1,000 more U.S. troops into Syria. While the ISIS caliphate seems doomed, this six-year Syrian war is far from over. An al-Qaeda subsidiary, the Nusra Front, has become the most formidable rebel fighting group. Syria's army, with the backing of Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and Shiite militias from across the Middle East, has carved out most of the territory it needs. The Turkish army is now in Syria, beside its rebel allies, their main enemy, Syria's Kurds, who are America's allies. From our longest war, Afghanistan, comes word from U.S. General John Nicholson that we and our Afghan allies are in a stalemate with the Taliban, and he will need a few thousand more U.S. troops to augment the 8,500 President Barack Obama left behind when he left office. Some 5,000 U.S. troops are in Iraq, helping to liberate Mosul from ISIS. In Kabul, Baghdad, and Damascus, terrorist bombings are a weekly, if not a daily, occurrence. Then there is the U.S. troop buildup in Poland and the Baltic, the U.S. deployment of a missile defense to South Korea after multiple missile tests in North Korea, and Russia and China talking of upgrading their nuclear arsenals to counter U.S. missile defenses in Poland, Romania, and South Korea. In and around the waters of the Persian Gulf, United States warships are harassed by Iranian patrol boats, as Tehran tests fires anti-ship and anti-aircraft missiles to send the Americans a message, attack us and it will not be a cakewalk war. With the death of communism, the end of the Cold War, and the collapse of the Bushite New World Order, America needs a new grand strategy, built upon the solid foundation of America First, and that is not Senator McCain's vision. Repeal or Obamacare Lite, new GOP health care bill keeps worst of previous system. By Rep. Ron Paul, the House of Representatives is expected to vote on a Republican bill soon that supposedly repeals Obamacare. However, the bill retains Obamacare's most destructive features. That is not to say this legislation is entirely without merit. For example, the bill expands the amount individuals can contribute to a health savings account, HSA. HSAs allow individuals to save money tax-free to pay for routine medical expenses. By restoring individuals' control over healthcare dollars, HSAs remove the distortions introduced in the healthcare market by government policies encouraging over-reliance on third-party payers. The legislation also contains other positive tax changes, such as a provision allowing individuals to use healthcare tax credits to purchase a catastrophic-only insurance policy. Ideally, health insurance should only cover major or catastrophic health events. No one expects their auto insurance to cover routine oil changes, so why should they expect health insurance to cover routine checkups? Unfortunately, the bill's positive aspects are more than outweighed by its failure to repeal Obamacare's regulations and price controls. Like all price controls, Obamacare distorts the signals that a freely functioning marketplace sends to consumers and producers, thus guaranteeing chaos in the marketplace. The result of this chaos is higher prices, reduced supply, and lowered quality. Two particularly insidious Obamacare regulations are guaranteed issue and community ratings. As the name suggests, guaranteed issue forces health insurance companies to issue a health insurance policy to anyone who applies for coverage. Community ratings forces health insurance companies to charge an obese couch potato and a physically fit jogger similar premiums. This forces the jogger to subsidize the couch potato's unhealthy lifestyle. Obamacare's individual mandate was put in place to ensure that guaranteed issue and community ratings would not drive health insurance companies out of business. Rather than repealing guaranteed issue and community ratings, the House Republicans' plan forces those who go longer than 2 months without health insurance to pay a penalty to health insurance companies when they purchase new policies. It is hard to feel sympathy for the insurance companies since they supported Obamacare. These companies were eager to accept government regulations in exchange for a mandate that individuals buy their product. But we should feel sympathy for Americans who are struggling to afford, or even obtain, health care because of Obamacare and who will obtain little or no relief from Obamacare 2.0. The underlying problem with the Republican proposal is philosophical. The plan put forth by the alleged pro-free market Republicans implicitly accepts the premise that healthcare is a right that must be provided by government. But rights are inalienable aspects of our humanity, not gifts from government. If government can give us rights, then it can also limit or even take away those rights. Giving government power to enforce a fictitious right to healthcare justifies government theft and coercion. Thievery and violence do not suddenly become moral when carried out by governments. Treating healthcare as a right leads to government intervention, which, as we have seen, inevitably leads to higher prices and lower quality. This is why, with the exception of those specialties, like plastic surgery, that are still treated as goods, not rights, healthcare is one of the few areas where innovation leads to increased costs. America's healthcare system will only be fixed when a critical mass of people rejects the philosophical and economic fallacies justifying government-run healthcare. Those of us who know the truth must continue to work to spread the ideas of, and grow the movement for, liberty.